My name is Fernando Leyva. I'm from the Latin American and Caribbean Studies Department. It is my my pleasure to introduce Peter Kornbluth from the National Security Archive. The National Security Archive is a nonprofit organization located at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., that analyzes and fights for the declassification of U.S. government documents as they relate to what happens in different parts of the world. Peter is the director of the Chile Documentation Project, and we're very fortunate that he has agreed to come and talk on another one of his projects, this one on the Bay of Pigs documentation. Today is the 40th anniversary of that invasion, and Peter is the author of a book called Bay of Pigs Declassified, the Secret CIA Report on the Invasion of Cuba. And he's going to talk about the book, the work of the National Security Archive, and mostly an extraordinary conference that just took place in Cuba that brought together former CIA operatives, members of the 2506 Brigade, and Cuban government officials to discuss this event. So please, let's give Peter a warm
welcome. Thank you. I want you to picture this scene, if you will. A CIA official who, in the early 1960s, spent a good deal of his time trying to figure out how to assassinate Fidel Castro. A CIA official who was the guy who picked up an encyclopedia of Caribbean shells and flipped through it until he could find a shell that was big enough to disguise a bomb, that was a shell that would be organic to the waters off of Cuba's coast. Eventually, the CIA official found a shell, a conch shell, in the encyclopedia and said, that's it. And sent the book over to the Technical Services Division of the CIA and said, use this shell, create a false shell with a bomb inside. Then his superior came in and said, okay, well, we're working on this. We've got the shell, we're building the bomb, but I have one question for you. The idea here is we're going to put this shell in the waters where Fidel goes scuba diving. How are we going to get him to pick up this particular shell? Are we going to put a sign on it that says, hello, pick me up? How are we going to pursue this scheme? The same CIA official who gets together a whole set of equipment that includes a poison pen and gives it to an emissary who flies off to Paris in November of 1963 to deliver it to a high-level Cuban military defector who the CIA has turned and is going to be used to try and assassinate Fidel. This CIA official, 3 weeks ago, sitting at a lunch table with Fidel Castro, the man that he had spent all this time trying to assassinate, and discussing the history of these assassination efforts, of the Bay of Pigs invasion, of the larger set of CIA covert operations to overthrow the Cuban Revolution. This was one of the symbols for me of how much times have changed since the early 1960s, to a point where it was possible for this CIA official and one of his colleagues to go to Cuba along with five brigade members from the invasion force that landed on the beaches of what the Cubans call Playa Girón at 1 o'clock in the morning 40 years ago today, along with Kennedy administration officials such as Arthur Schlesinger and Richard Goodwin. Times have changed such that they could go and sit in a conference room with Fidel Castro and his military officials and discuss this history. Times have changed even if U.S. policy, for the most part, has not. And that's one of the reasons why it's so much fun, frankly, and so interesting and still so relevant to study history like the Bay of Pigs invasion, because without really understanding the Bay of Pigs invasion, we don't really understand how U.S. policy and U.S.-Cuban relations got to the point they are today and why they're stuck at that point. I could give you a whole rundown on the history of the Bay of Pigs, but suffice to say that this was the point when the United States put itself inextricably on the path of perpetual hostility towards Cuba, an act of rather bold aggression, an invasion of a smaller neighbor. It was an episode that led almost directly in its aftermath to the Cuban Missile Crisis, the 40th anniversary of which is next a year from this October. It is an episode that had tremendous impact in Cuba, in United States, and in U.S.-Cuban relations. In Cuba, it was an episode that helped a very young revolutionary government that had only been in power for 2 years at that point consolidate its power and its rule. A few months after the invasion took place, there was a secret meeting in Montevideo, Uruguay, between Che Guevara and one of Kennedy's aides, Richard Goodwin. And the first thing Guevara said to Goodwin was, "Thank you for the Bay of Pigs. It helped us consolidate our divided revolution." And in the eyes of the world, it elevated us to an equal with you in the international community. So thank you for that invasion. Then he said, "Now could we get about the business of improving and normalizing our relations with you," which of course never happened, but that was the gist of what the meeting was about. In Cuba, the Bay of Pigs obviously had just a tremendous impact that continues to resonate today. Those of you who get on the internet and watch what goes on in Cuba, read the Cuban press, are going to see today, tomorrow, and the next day kind of parades and speeches and demonstrations about which something that really will go down in the history of Latin America as the one time that a small Latin American country actually defeated the Goliath of the North. And that's what's being celebrated in Cuba today. In the United States, the invasion had an extraordinary impact as well. It had an extraordinary impact in its immediate aftermath. The Kennedy brothers were just so angry that they had that this had happened to them. Was John Kennedy, who had only been in office for less than 100 days, I think, at that point. This was an incredible embarrassment, not only for him personally, but for the United States in the eyes of the world community overall. This was supposed to have been a covert operation that the United States could plausibly deny. And instead, not only was it an overt operation that they had to accept responsibility for, but it had failed as well. And in fact, this is an episode in the Cold War that has been dubbed the perfect failure in every level, in every category, in every objective. The invasion of Cuba failed. It failed militarily. It failed as a covert operation. It failed diplomatically when in front of the United Nations, the United States was exposed not only as an aggressor, but also as a liar. The CIA had misled our ambassador to the UN about the reality of this invasion, and he had presented this false cover story to the entire General Assembly, which reporters immediately were able to uncover and reveal as just a real pack of lies, and our credibility was shot. Instead of weakening the Castro revolution, it helped it consolidate. And finally, instead of getting rid of a potential Soviet ally in the Caribbean, the invasion pushed Cuba forcefully into the Soviet orbit. Yesterday, 40 years ago yesterday, was the day that Fidel Castro declared Cuba a socialist state. He did so at the funerals of the victims of the first bombing run that U.S. backed planes had led the preliminary airstrike for the Bay of Pigs invasion, which dozens of Cuban civilians and soldiers were killed. And at the funeral, Fidel, for the first time, declared Cuba to be a socialist state. He did so in order to signal the Soviet Union that Cuba was in need of their diplomatic and political and eventual military support in the face of what was clearly a pending U.S. Attack. So it failed at every level. And this is what makes it so important to study. One of its lasting impacts is on U.S. domestic politics. It continues to resonate in our international relations with Cuba, but also in our domestic political situation, because when the brigade members who were captured, almost 1,300 of them who were captured at the Bay of Pigs, were finally released 18 months later by the Castro regime, they came back to Florida, for the most part, where their families were. A number of them trained with the U.S. military and the CIA to continue covert warfare against Cuba. Others became established businessmen, political figures in the Florida area, and a number of them became very prominent political actors. In fact, the whole hardline anti-Castro community in Miami is built around the remnants of the brigade and the Veterans Association of the brigade. And these are the political forces who have organized themselves very well for a small minority, who have held U.S. policy hostage to the 24 electoral votes that Florida has. And anybody who works on Cuba and wants to see a change in U.S. policy studies the demographics and voting groups in Florida, because U.S. presidents, one after the other, have constantly looked at Florida and at the next election in Florida to see what policies they could pursue and what policies they could not pursue in order to keep or gain votes from the Cuban American community. This is why Al Gore was so wishy-washy on the case of Elian Gonzalez, if any of you remember, and kind of pandered to this community, because he knew that he was going to have to pick up at least a percentage of Cuban American votes in order to take Florida. And one of the there were many unfortunate things about the outcome of this last presidential election. Whether you were a Democrat or a Republican, I have to say there were many unfortunate things about the outcome when it comes down to disputed ballots and the lack of a clear mandate for the president who eventually took office, George Bush, and the possibility that will always exist that he didn't actually win the vote in Florida. But one of the key things that was regrettable is the fact that all small interest groups in Florida who voted for Bush could lay claim to being pivotal in his election. And certainly the Cuban American community, which overwhelmingly voted for Bush, given that his brother was governor of the state, and given that the Cuban exile community, unlike all other minority groups in this country, are predominantly and have predominantly voted Republican. This group has even more power today because of what happened in Florida and the disputed votes than they might otherwise have had, even with the brother of the sitting president being the governor there. And we're going to see that power exhibited in a number of ways and through a number of political appointments on Latin America that George Bush is currently making. So studying the Bay of Pigs has all sorts of ramifications, historical and current, and that's what makes it so interesting. We chose to study it on this 40th anniversary in a kind of a unique way, and that was to gather together a delegation from the United States, bring them to Havana to sit down with their counterparts and to discuss this history with all sides at the table. And I just want to share with you, I think some of the aspects of this unique conference, which was both a historical conference and a historic conference. we set out to do three things. One was to advance the history of the Bay of Pigs, and to do that by getting new documents declassified, by pushing the Cubans to declassify some of their records on this episode, by bringing together actors who, in some ways, who had been fighting against each other physically at the battle spot, or who politically had been adversaries during this actual invasion planning, and to share all of that history. Our first goal then was to advance the history, and we used a methodology. Since some of you are political science students, perhaps others historians, I'll just lay out. It's a very interesting, very simple methodology. It's called critical oral history. Oral history is what you probably heard reference to the most. It's obviously a technique that historians use. You take a tape recorder and you go sit down with a historical figure and you say, what happened? And a lot of people do that. My mother is a labor historian, and she's done thousands of hours of oral history tapes with historical figures from the American labor movement, and particularly female and women labor leaders throughout the years. It's a very interesting approach, but it has one flaw, and that is it relies totally on the memories and the selectivity of the individual who you are interviewing. Critical oral history is slightly different. It combines three factors, three components: the actual historical actors, key declassified documents that those actors may have written or may have read and need to explain, and then it brings in the experts. It brings in the actors, the evidence, and the experts, the scholars, all in the same place. And the role of the scholars is to put this evidence in front of the historical actors, to ask specific questions drawn from the documents, and to keep the actors focused on the actual evidence in the documents as opposed to somewhat more superficial recollections. And this was the methodology that we intended to use and use at this conference to advance the history of the Bay of Pigs. Our second objective was to balance the history of the Bay of Pigs. Those of you who are Latin Americans by birth probably have a sense that there's something in almost imperialistic about the way history is written when it involves the United States and Latin America. It's almost always based on U.S. documents and the U.S. perspective. And that those are the books that get circulated and get studied. Usually you have a situation where victors write the history. That's a common expression. The victors get to write the history. But in the case of the Bay of Pigs, the history has largely been written by the losers. The brigade members who came back to Miami wrote their own books in Spanish for the Miami, Florida community. The actors on the U.S. side, the Kennedy administration officials, the CIA personnel, wrote their memoirs, their recollections, and those were the books and the articles that got studied. From that, we drew the lessons and our sense of what actually happened at the Bay of Pigs. And what happened with that? What happened with that is that the whole discussion about this history was based on the losing side and on the U.S. side, and it was basically a debate about why the invasion failed. It was never a debate about why Cuba won. It was always about why the invasion failed. And the historiography of the Bay of Pigs was dominated by two distinct arguments about its failure. the Kennedy administration officials who wrote their memoirs, like Arthur Schlesinger most predominantly, basically pointed the finger at the CIA, saying, you guys came to the White House, you totally misled the president about the possibility of the success of this. You left the impression that these invaders could fade into the mountains thereafter. And you misled us. And so Kennedy, and even worse, you didn't listen to the president when he said he wasn't going to send military troops in after these guys if the thing went bad. So you misled us, and you misled the brigade members themselves, and consequently they got abandoned on the beach. The CIA, in contrast, has always pointed the finger of blame at the Kennedy White House, particularly the president himself. CIA officials privately and then publicly in the mid-1960s and in memoirs that have been published over the years have repeatedly said the reason this failed was because John Kennedy got cold feet. He cut the first preliminary airstrike in half. This was the airstrike that was supposed to take out all of Fidel's air force so that the invasion force could have control of the skies and control of the ground without having to deal with any planes, because if those, you know, in a paramilitary assault on a beach, the side that controls the air is the side that's likely to win. And John Kennedy cut in half the first airstrike, and then he totally canceled the second airstrike, which was supposed to take place on the morning of the invasion 40 years ago today. And therefore, we weren't able to take out Castro's air force, and we lost. He sunk, his air force sunk the supply ships with the gasoline and the guns and the bullets, and once those were sunk, there was no way that the brigade could be resupplied, and they were destined to lose. That has dominated the debate internationally over and here in the United States over this history. So the idea of this conference was to balance this history by letting the Cubans for the first time bring their side of the history to the table in a credible manner with the attention of the world focused on their presentation. So not only did we bring a delegation of former officials and scholars to Cuba, but we also brought about 100 members of the press from around the world who got there before us and were all waiting for us when we got off the plane. It was almost like paparazzi. It was such an amazing scene when we actually landed in Havana. And one of the things that I did was to convince the Cuban government that the only way it could credibly put its side of this history on the table is if it did something that in a closed communist society is very rare, kind of broke through the pathology of secrecy and declassified some of its own internal records about what happened. I would have brought some of these documents to show you, but they're pretty heavy. The briefing book, the Cuban briefing book, was quite heavy, and the U.S. briefing book, which was of declassified documents, was 800 pages. That's like carrying two reams of paper almost, and I just thought you'd have to leave it to your imagination to see how big these things were. But and they did declassify some documents, some of which were quite interesting, and they got a lot of attention, a lot of credit for that, and it certainly helped us evaluate a number of the key questions. They declassified some intelligence reports that they had done before the invasion, which gave us a real sense of what information they had been able to, their security forces had been able to gather about the CIA training in Guatemala of the brigade members, about the how they scoured the U.S. press for details, what they got right, what they got wrong, etc. We learned at the conference that they did not actually have spies inside the camps in Guatemala, even though they did have spies around the camps among kind of Guatemala's peasantry, and some of the political actors in Guatemala were feeding them information. And they obviously had intelligence officers in Miami and in Washington as well. So this is the way that we attempted to balance the history. The third objective of the conference was to use the history and to use the historical opportunity to talk as much about the future as about the past. This was, as I said, a historical conference that was also historic. The idea that two former CIA operatives could go to Cuba, civilly sit down with Fidel Castro was a kind of a stunning symbol. An even more stunning symbol was the idea that former members of the brigade itself could go to Cuba, actually meet with the very people that were shooting at them on the beach during the fighting, could meet with Fidel Castro himself, shake hands, and discuss this history. One of the most, clearly the most poignant moment of the conference, which was actually written about a little bit in the New York Times, was when the leading brigade member, Alfredo Duran, went up to the map. There was a big map on the wall at the front of the conference room of the Bay of Pigs and the various beaches where the landings were. Fidel Castro was already up there with a pointer saying, our forces were here and our forces were there. And Alfredo Duran comes up and he says, well, we landed here and then we moved to this position and then we were pinned down by artillery fire coming from right here. And Castro goes, yeah, you know, the artillery officer who led that battalion is standing right over there. Jose, come over here and meet the guy you were shooting at. And, you know, this captain walks over and he shakes hands with Alfredo Duran and everybody starts to clap. Part of that would, this was not a televised, or the press was not in the room. There was not, this was not meant to be some public display for propaganda reasons, et cetera. It was just was something that happened. But what was so poignant about it is that for Alfredo Duran, and I think for the Cuban official as well, it was the moment when the history finally was put behind them. It was an extremely emotional moment for them and for everybody watching. You could just feel it. They both talked about it afterwards, and obviously was a life-changing moment for particularly Alfredo Duran, when all the fear of that particular battle that he had lived with and the difficulty of this past, he was able to confront and share this history with the person that had been on the other side. And they both understood that they were both scared at the time, and they both almost lost their lives. And in the end, they had lived to tell and to share this history, not only separately, but together. The symbol of this, we hoped, would be a model for the possibility in the future of civil dialogue between the United States and Cuba. The idea that bitter former antagonists could sit down and have a historical discussion without any anger, without rancor, indeed with a good degree of camaraderie, we hoped would be a dramatic a demonstration for the Miami community of what is possible, as well as for the broader community on policy, that works on policy towards Cuba, both in Cuba and in the United States. And, you know, there in Cuba, the Bay of Pigs is still a very difficult topic. There's no doubt about it. There are a lot of people there who lost relatives during the invasion, a lot of people who were injured. There's been 40 years of propaganda against the brigade, calling them mercenaries. The Cubans made a clear decision. We are going to put that into the past. When these people are here, we're going to treat them with respect. The word mercenary is not going to be used during the conference. We're going to refer to them as members of the brigade. At the very end of the conference, the third day, we went to the Bay of Pigs. The Florida Sun Sentinel, the second major newspaper in Miami, took a photograph of two of the brigade members and one former Cuban intelligence officer and a Cuban colonel, both, all four of them walking kind of arm in arm down the beach at the Bay of Pigs. And that was on the front page of the Sun Sentinel when we came back, and I think dramatically captured the idea that there could be some reconciliation here around this historical issue. A number of other things happened while we were at the Bay of Pigs itself. Obviously, it was a very emotional moment for a lot of people who hadn't spent any time there in the last 40 years and remembered vividly how difficult it was. I mean, any military confrontation is traumatic, and this one was no exception for any of the people who were actually fighting there. But one of the things that did happen is, through kind of some back-channel negotiations that took place, the brigade members, the five brigade members that came from the United States, did get an agreement from the Cuban government to put a wreath in front of a monument that was created by the Cuban government for the Cuban soldiers who were killed during the fighting at the Bay of Pigs. There were 150 Cuban soldiers and civilians who died from the U.S.-directed bombing attacks, and the brigade planes were using napalm bombs, and a lot of strafing, a lot of shooting went on for 3 days. And a monument, a wall with names on it, had been built in front of the museum, and the brigade members said, we would like to place a wreath that reflects the fact that not only did those 150 Cubans die from the island, but also 115 members of our brigade died there too. And we aren't going to place a wreath to the brigade members that died. We want to place a wreath to todos los caídos, all of the fallen at Playa Girón. And finally, again, with a lot of running back and forth at the last minute, that was agreed to, and they did place this wreath there. And I had actually thought that the Cuban government would kind of leave this at treat this as kind of a very quick propaganda thing, and as soon as we got on the buses and left, that they would take the wreath down and tear it up. But they actually left it there for several days. We sent somebody back 2 days later to see if it was still there, and it was still there for anybody visiting Playa Girón to see. And that also became a symbol of what needs to happen if Cuban U.S. relations are ever going to be changed, and that is that the Cuban exiles who live in Florida and the Cubans who are on the island have to build some kind of political and emotional bridge, which starts with acknowledging that there were two sides involved in this history. And that wreath, I think, represented that. And as one of the leading Cuban exile, Cuban brigade member that came to the island put it, Alfredo Duran, he said, you know, there never should be a time when Cubans are shooting at Cubans. We are all part of one family. Talking about this history is a way of saying, this is a type of aggression that should never take place in the future. And that's the message we left with. Thank you.